Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Tuesday night edition. Today's date is the second day of February 2010. My name is Daryl Bradford-Smith. Great to have you here for another important broadcast. We have a discussion planned for you this evening on historic events, very important events, in fact, ladies and gentlemen. From what I just shared with my guest that will be coming up in just 2 or 3 minutes here, is that the founding of Israel, while the date is claimed to be 1948, in fact, the wheels were placed in motion much sooner than that, much earlier than that. We can find activity that were set in motion back in 1885 when attempts were made to purchase the area of Palestine from the Caliphate, from the Ottoman Empire Caliph in Turkey. And he refused. He would not sell out his Palestinian subjects in that area. And then this group set in motion events, world events, that would take from him that region, and in fact take from him the entire empire that had been formed around his rule. And so, but the machinations and the horrors and the murder and the subterfuge and the crimes that were part and parcel of this founding of this criminal state of Israel, and I dare say to the listener, I believe Israel has absolutely zero right to even exist on this planet. They were stolen land from the beginning. They were based on a lie and deception, and they were seeded with murder and mayhem, and therefore, in my view, have absolutely no justifiable right to the land that they are now sitting upon. And we will prove that today with historic events in conversation with my guest, James Dickey, who I've had on many, many times. We've spoken about many, many subjects, including events in South Africa. James, like myself, has been kicked off of radio in South Africa, and so have I. We've got a lot of things to talk in common, and I wear that as a badge of honor, James, the fact that I can't speak on radio in South Africa anymore for telling the truth, and I know that also happened to you. But I'm going to bring him up right now. James, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, James Dickey is also known as Yaakov Zaki in the Muslim world. He is a follower of Islam, and he has been studying these events, the things that we're going to discuss today, for a long time. He acknowledges the fact that I know some things he maybe didn't, and he's got some stuff that I don't know. We're going to try to pool the resources and use some of the research that my dear friend Mohammed Rafiq put together back on the French Connections 2007 article he wrote. The article is on the website. You can see it and read it there. It was put together on August 24th, 2007, and it was named "The Facts Behind the Overthrow of the Ottoman Sultanate." And you will find it's full of great information. But we're going to start this out by saying, welcome to you, James. And do you have anything to share before we get started in this conversation?
No, I'm too eager to get into it, Donald.
Well, I am too. Now, you know, one of the things that these people involved in this new Zionist movement, and that's what it became. You know, let's call it what they called it. They were formulating a new movement within their own messianic or aggressive plans, and that was to set up a place where they could run their operations out of, unencumbered by national or local government. They would have their own place to be calling home, and thereby, because the Jews were so well dispersed, immediately have a network around the world to which to run their operations out of. And they needed a place, and they chose Palestine as that place because it fit a lot of the things they needed to claim. One of them was a right that they're chosen, that they're better than others. That I mean, going back to the land where biblical information was put into the world, especially in the Christian world, would give them some sort of basis for their claims. And basically, at the same time, we had people like, what's his name over there, writing the Bible, rewriting the Schofield was putting metatext into his Bible, giving credence to this Judeo-Christian belief. The Jews and Christians have almost never agreed on Christian beliefs until this last couple of hundred years. So, what do you see as their motivation, and where was it that you see the beginnings of their interest in Palestine in your historic work?
You're asking me, Darrell?
Yes, I am asking
you. Yeah. Well, I think that both Bolshevism and Zionism, and Zionism is a secular religion, really, were spawned in the Pale of Settlement in Russia.
Yes.
It's to say you would have, for instance, in one family, one son, let's call him Moshe, would be a Zionist, and his other son, Reuben, would be a Bolshevist. And you can just picture the scenes, can't you, over the dinner table, the two going at it hammer and tongs over the table, over the merits of their respective creeds, and the Yiddish or mama in the background say, oh, just leave me, just give me a moment's peace. One can picture the scene, can't one? But the thing is that both are Jewish.
Yes, yes, that's right. And now we can look, we can see the roots of this, not only in Ashkenazi Judaism, but also it had its proponents within the Sephardic movement, and this was the beginning of the merger of these two disparate groups. Now, they were not considered tightly organized together until this Zionist movement began to really work its crime wave around the world. And this started in earnest in 1890. Am I correct to say that?
One can go further back than that. I mean, everybody thinks that it began with the publication of Herzl's book, Das Judenstaat. But in fact, he had two or three predecessors. One can trace the roots of the whole thing back to the 1850s. And then it becomes really serious after the first pogrom in Russia and Poland in 1881.
And now those pogroms were motivated by the public starting to recognize that everything in their community was being owned or operated by a small clique of Jews, and they resented the control, and they resented the wealth that they were amassing on the backs of their society. Is that fair to say?
They resented also the alien nature of their new masters. You see, the Tsar, who was the little father, the protecting friend of the Russian people, saw it as his duty to protect the Russian people against these new boyars, because the power of the boyars had really been broken by Peter the Great. He gave them different titles, you know, prince and count, Western titles, so that by the mid-19th century, they had really been tamed. Of course, Russia was an autocracy. It was the only way you could govern an immense empire, stretching all the way from St. Petersburg to Vladivostok, a continent, rather indeed than more than a state, in fact. And so he confined the Tsar of that time, the Jews, to the Pale of Settlement. And they're festering in their staminets inside and their shekels inside the Pale. They come up with those two theories of what to do, how to get out of the Pale, and what they would do once they were out of it.
This is why they talk about beyond the Pale, yes?
No, that goes back to a previous Pale, which was the Protestant Pale round about Dublin in the 17th century.
Okay, well, then I...
Pale just means paling. It's a fence, like what Israel has built up now on Arab land round about the occupied territories.
Well, what we've got here, and now the first name I'd like to bring into this conversation, because he's the most famous name associated with the Young Turk Revolution. His name was Emmanuel Carasso. And, of course, Carasso he was given a carte blanche from many sources, including financing, including connections to people such as Jabotinsky, including Parvis, including... I mean, there were a lot of people that this guy was working with, but also a guy named Ataturk. And they organized themselves.
No, he wasn't Ataturk at that time. He was just Mustafa Kemal.
That's right.
And judging from the name, was an ordinary Orthodox Muslim. In fact, he was nothing of the kind. His mother married twice, and the second father was a crypto-Jew, Adonai.
And that's right. Now, we see that they figured out a way to keep the caliph and the sultan from knowing about their plans by using the age-old and tried-and-true system of Freemasonry, because it's quite secret, and it can be manipulated and used, especially since you often find the Freemasons and their like are very well ensconced in business and finance and money,
So they use this these connections, and they use them well in order to foment this this crime wave. Am I correct?
Yes, indeed you are. You see, the Masonic lodges, since Freemasonry is a secret society and non-Masons are banned from their temples and their rituals, and the Masons themselves, in the various degrees of admission, have to pronounce the most frightful oaths of what will happen to them should they divulge the secrets of the society. Now, these temples were the ideal places where to hatch a conspiracy, because, as you know, Sultan Abdul Hamid Sani was a paranoid individual, intellectually brilliant, who was trying to save the Ottoman Empire from disintegration. He had this network of spies everywhere, even in Britain. I now find that he had agents in Portsmouth, and other ones, Mustafa Khalil Bey, a Syrian, reporting on a man called Abdullah Quilliam in Liverpool, who professed to be a Muslim, but in fact seems to have been a double, or perhaps even just a single agent. So that in this atmosphere of paranoia, the ideal place to hatch a conspiracy was the lodge.
Yes, yes. Now, we see that the lodge's structure, especially the Orient Lodge structure, we're not talking about the York Rite structure, but the Grand Orient Lodge, which was based, its home base was in Paris, gave its blessings and its right to exist to the Turin Lodge in Italy. And then Italy's lodge gave rights to other lodges that were spawned in the Greek area, which at the time was under the Ottoman control. And we see that Salonika, Greece, was given a charter, as well as one in Constantinople, which was also a place with a hotbed of Donmay Young Turk activity. Now,
well, the lodge in Thessalonica, which is derivative from the Grand Lodge of Italy, in its turn, derivative from the Grand Lodge of the Orient, headquartered in Paris, that lodge in Thessalonica spawned 66 lodges in the Ottoman Empire, including Egypt, which in 1882 had passed under the control of the British. But nevertheless, Freemasonry was active there. And the two leading Islamic revivalists of the period, Jamaluddin al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu, were both members of a lodge. These lodges, these 66 lodges, were dispersed throughout Anatolia, Rumelian Turkey, Syria, and Egypt. Let's say practically the whole empire.
Well, now, so they had their network being built, and the upper echelons of power within this organization were now, I've done some research on this, and we find that there were actually people involved in this lodge structure that had connections to the Bolshevik Revolution up in Russia that was taking place around the same time. And we see the name Jabotinsky, who was an employee of Carasso, on one of his newspapers, which is astonishing.
Jabotinsky was a brilliant journalist.
Yes.
Like Cremieux, who was also a journalist. The prominence of journalists in these Judeo-Masonic circles at that time is quite remarkable.
Well, but it's
beginning with Herzl himself, who was a journalist.
But it's important to note that these people's activities were actually running in parallel in at this very tumultuous time in world history, where they needed to unseat the Sultanate. They also needed to unseat the Tsar, and they were well into their job doing this in both places, and they were conspiring together to get it done.
You are right. The interests ran in parallel, but at a certain point they converged, and that point of convergence is 1914 and the outbreak of the Great War, which had two objectives. One was to convert Holy Russia into an atheist state, under the Bolsheviks, to dethrone the Tsar Nicholas II because he was an anti-Semite, and he was the patron of Professor Nilus, who published the protocols in Moscow in, I think, 1905, and then and at the same time to bring about the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, so that after its demise, Palestine could be colonized by those same Jews who had fled from Tsarist persecution.
Well, now, we have a figure coming to the fore here named Mehmet Cavit. Now, M-E-H-M-E-T, Cavit, C-A-V-I-T, Mehmet Cavit Bey, his name was, and he died in 1926. He was a significant Donmei figure, and his activities in the revolution as highly articulate editor of the tabloid and professor of finance that was three times finance minister of modern Turkey after its inception, until his execution for alleged role in an assassination attempt on Ataturk. It is believed that this Cavit Bey was an ardent Zionist and saw advantages for Turkey in the Jewish settlements of Palestine. Now, it's interesting because what ends up happening with this guy Cavit, and I'm bringing this in a little soon here, but when the Ataturk was going to have him put to death, none other than Rothschild himself stepped in and asked him not to do it. Interestingly. And this came to the fore at the time. Now, the Rothschild that did this was named... I'm looking on my notes here. House of Rothschild, blah, blah, blah. So much stuff here to read. Well... But it's interesting because, I'll bring it out up in a minute, but it's also interesting that there was influence from the Jewish community of New York by virtue of the fact that a man named Morgenthau, which you will recognize that name immediately, was the ambassador to this new Donmei-run Young Turk movement. As soon as they took their government over, Morgenthau was put right into the position of liaison and ambassador from the United States. No shocker there, because the influence of the Zionists was also exploding in the American government at the same time.
Yeah.
So
yes.
It's so now when we get back here to reading this now, Cavit, false trails. Let's go down a little further here. This revolution was examined, and the British, of course, at the time, the British Empire was the most powerful financial and military empire in the world, and they were having a lot of actions around the world. They were fighting skirmishes in India. They were fighting skirmishes in South Africa with the Boers. They were having problems in continental Europe. They found that they had a lot of things on their plate. Now, a lot of people tried after the fact to say that the British were responsible for the overthrow of the Caliphate. It seemed like an easy thing to claim because Britain had problems with the Ottomans, and of course in the World War I actually fought against them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but nothing could be farther from the truth. By virtue of the correspondences that were had with Mr. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, and the people from the Home Office that were working out of Turkey at the time said that it was an entirely Jewish Bolshevik-run organization that was doing most of the dirty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the British were as worried about what they were watching happen there in their governmental structure, but I'm certain there were elements within Britain that were pushing it forward. Because we know that the city of London, where Mr. Rothschild had his seat of power and control, wanted this to happen. So there were elements within the British realm that were trying to have this take place, and there were probably elements within the government hierarchy that were shocked by it all. What is your take on that part of it?
Well, what interests me is the racial origins and background of so many of the Young Turks. If we look at their names, the members of the Committee of Union and Progress, a key one is Talat Bey, then Bentri Bey, Mebekri Bey, and Javit Bey. Now, Javit Bey was a Donmei, a follower of Sabbatai Zvi.
Yep.
And amongst the many Jews in attendance Two of the most prominent were the head of the security service, Samuel Effendi, and the vice administrator of the police, Abraham Bey. And all this was going on under Sultan Abdulhamid II. And it gets worse and worse, because there are just so many names involved that it's truly extraordinary.
But what we find also very interesting is that in order for them to take full control over this disintegrating empire, which was the Ottoman Empire, there were people that were vying for independence and power. You had alliances that these young Turks made with the Kurds, because they had an uprising against their rule from Armenians. You also had the Greek Orthodox community that had been living in peace for many, many centuries inside the Ottoman Empire, all of a sudden being jettisoned from the country, and in that jettisoning, many millions of Greek Orthodox Christians died in this exodus. So the Armenians, generally speaking, are also Christians. So what happened here was that they set about to create hatred, enmity, and derision within the crumbling empire, so that they could further their own goals, and ultimately there were terrible pogroms against the Armenians and the Greeks that erupted. And I've got information that say as many as a million Greeks were killed, but even higher numbers of Armenians. You want to talk a little bit about what you know about the Donmay, the Young Turks, and how the Armenians were killed by this group, ordered to be killed?
One of the theoreticians of the Young Turk movement was Ziyar Nikolavi, who was a Kurd, and the major planner of tactics and theory was a Jew from Serres called Takin Ali. His real name was Moshe Cohen. So it's like, you know, the Bolshevik conspirators in Russia at the same time. I mean, Lenin's real name was not Lenin at all, and Stalin's real name was not Stalin at all. They adopted these revolutionary names, and in fact, in many cases, they were cover for Jewish origin, because, for instance, Trotsky.
Yes. Well, now, see, but this whole concept of crypto-Judaism goes back to Sabbatai C.
In the 17th century,
that's
yes.
That's right. And so that's why I'm telling you that I know, even in advance of Cremieux taking over the Orient Lodge in the 1860s in Paris and becoming a very prominent member of Freemasonry, they already had clandestinely entered those lodges as crypto-Jews and were managing policy as early as 1815, 1820. So they had a lot of these plans made early. You said 1850, they were already putting a lot of this into motion.
Mm. Yes, it goes a long way back.
It does, in fact. But one of the things that most people don't understand is that the goal, ultimately, was to first steal an area of land close to an area of religion that they could use as a dogmatic wedge. See, what they've done with taking the Holy Land as they have, and the fact that Christians have spent a lot of blood there and have a lot of their religious faith generated from that area, they could use it as an emotional sledgehammer whenever they needed it to be, as long as they were seen as the protectors of that area. And so they set themselves up to be, as far as their control, to be, Judeo-Christians, which is not true. This is a lie that many Americans and Europeans have believed for some time, James.
Oh, they have fallen for it in a big way.
They have.
I mean, the Christian Zionists in America, one of their major sources of financial and political support, and also dispensationalist theology.
That's right.
This is very very powerful within the American psyche, you know. This goes right back to the Mayflower and the people who fled from religious discrimination in England at that time.
Well, I actually heralded from the people that got off that Mayflower, Wilcox family and the Manchesters and many others. So my roots go back to that, and there is a very strong ties to independence from freedoms in your religious doctrine. However, What the people don't understand is that at the same time these things were put in motion, we had people like Schofield trying to rewrite the Christian base of their religion by saying this is how these things should be interpreted. He didn't write the Bible over again. The King James Bible remained the same. But what he did is he texted and meta-texted the interpretations to say, well, what they're really trying to say here is this, and what they're really trying to say here is that. And as he did that, what he did is he formed a basis of opinion that shifted people's belief systems toward Judaism.
Yes. Well, it's an exegetical Bible, isn't it?
Well, exactly right. And
so
now,
it's a Judeo-Zionist exegesis, understanding of the biblical texts.
That's right. Because so much of it is written in almost poetic prose that you can, it's not, some of it's not straightforward, and you have to interpret some of what it says, and that's why they have many classes around the world called Bible study. But if you've got your Bible study class giving you an interpretation that favors Messianic Judaism, then all of a sudden your beliefs are going to be allied with them, and you're going to give them the kind of support that they've garnered over this last century and a half. And to the detriment of the rest of us. So, but now we move into this next phase, and it's something you brought up in our private conversation just before coming on air. Once they had taken control of Palestine, they began rather slowly, but with deliberateness, to bring in an infrastructural change to that region. And the first groups of Jews that arrived, 1880, 90, 1900, that had already begun filtering in there, they were not at odds with the population there. They had not come in large waves. They were not omnipresent as they had become later. So they basically set up an infrastructure until they really needed a population to migrate. Now, this is important, I think, because this is exactly what you brought up a moment ago. They needed an exodus, and the Jews themselves, being cosmopolitan where they lived, didn't want to go live in a strip of desert in the Middle East. They needed to be forced there. Am I correct?
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's talk about some of the forcing that they did in the First World War, and they did it through the pogroms that were established in Russia first, didn't they?
Beginning in 1881, the big exodus of Ashkenazim toward Britain and America, and, as you say, in a lesser degree in Palestine. And they owned very little of the land in Palestine. You know that in 1948, when the United Nations, in its wisdom, partitioned the country called Palestine into two, a nascent Israel and a Palestinian state, they awarded 55% of the territory to less than one-third, I think 29% of the population. And at that time, the Jews owned only 5% of the land. And yet, this decree of the United Nations partitioning Palestine gave them 55% of the land.
Well, you know,
if that's not theft, what is?
Well, James, you know as well as I do that the United Nations has always been an organ of power that these people have controlled, and they still do today. You know, you can see that their hidden hand working all over that organization, and that people around the world have long been afraid of that United Nations because they do recognize that hidden Zionist Jewish hand behind it. However, let's move on a little bit here now and say, okay, what we've got the Armenians being slaughtered and the world believing that the Turks ordered this. Now, of course, the Turkish people had been sold a pile of hatred about the Armenians in their press and in their official doctrines that were coming out of this new Young Turk Dunmay controlled government. And the Turks, of course, felt like they were being victimized by the Armenians. But this was all a propagated sickness that happened. Am I correct?
Well, I'm not sure that, Darrell. I mean, let's look a bit at the history of the Ottoman Empire. First, the first point to note is it lasted for 600 years. That is to say, longer than the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire was a very slow and protracted affair. But an empire, the Ottoman Empire, that had lasted for 600 years collapsed in six. Now, there is no other case in history of an international empire on that scale collapsing within so few years. Not even the British Empire, which took 20 or 30 years to collapse after the Second World War. Now, the second point is it was a multinational empire and a tolerant one. Because Islam, being the youngest of the great world religions, had to devise a system for the regulation of the minorities. And in some places, the Christians were the majority. So that the millet system was devised whereby each religious community, that is, say, Jacobites, Greek Orthodox, Catholics, Maronites, etc., would have internal autonomy, extending even to their own legal system and their own legal courts, because since they did business mainly within their own community, it was necessary to regulate the affairs of that community legally with their own courts. Now, this tolerance was in fact the undoing of the Ottoman Empire, because it meant that whilst the Turks, the Muslims that is to say, because it includes the Egyptians and Syrians and Palestinians as well, whilst the Muslims were doing all the fighting, the Jews and the Christians were making all the money. So a point eventually was reached whereby the wealth of the empire was concentrated in the hands of groups that felt no loyalty toward the empire. And this is really what precipitated its collapse, and how a 600-year-old empire could come unstuck in only six years. Now, the Armenians latterly were disloyal, but not to begin with. For instance, Napoleon wanted to disrupt the Ottoman Empire. As you know, everybody thinks that Napoleon was defeated by the Tsar and then by the Duke of Wellington. Nonsense. The first man to defeat Napoleon was a Muslim, Djezar Bey, the governor of the Ottoman governor of Acre. And that was Napoleon's first military reverse. He came up against the military skill of the Ottomans. Now, Napoleon wrote a letter to the French ambassador in Constantinople and said, "Can't you stir up trouble amongst the Armenian population?" And the ambassador replied that the Armenians are so content with their life here, meaning they are busy making money, they are so content with their life here that which you seek is impossible. But by the end of the 19th century, all this had changed. Look, the defeat of Napoleon in the War of 1812 launched Russia as a major world power, of which other powers, great European powers like Britain and France and Austria-Hungary and ultimately Hohenzollern in Germany, all of them were afraid. Now, Russia, to become a great power, needed a warm water port. And there were several ways she thought she could get this. One was to take Constantinople on the Bosphorus, and that was her main drive throughout the latter part of the 19th century. It's the reason she created the state of Bulgaria out of the Danubian province of the Ottoman Empire. She was really out to get the Bosphorus, which would give her access to the Mediterranean. Another way was by taking over the weak and crumbling Persian Empire to get down through Azerbaijan, and Russia annexed northern Azerbaijan in 1817, and in 1945 and 46 she also tried to annex south Azerbaijan. Now that was to get a warm water port on the Persian Gulf. The third way was to use the Armenians to disrupt the Anatolian half of Turkey, because Turkey is really two countries, two geographical entities.
Yeah.
Rumelian Turkey, which is in Europe, that's say the Balkans, and Anatolian Turkey, which is in Asia Minor. Now, the Armenians inhabited the area around about Lake Van. That is the real Armenia, not the state in the former Soviet Union called Armenia. And the Tsars desperate to get their warm water port, their outlet to the Mediterranean, stirred up trouble amongst the Armenians, in eastern Anatolia, so that they became disloyal. Now, in 1915, when the Russian armies, and I think it was headed, the commander-in-chief of that sector was the brother of the Tsar, Grand Duke Nicholas, they invaded Turkey and got as far as Erzurum, which is in the vicinity of Lake Van. Now, knowing that the Armenians were going to side with the invading Russian forces, what the Ottoman government did is they removed them from the theater of warfare by forced marches, and a lot of people died. The Armenians claim 1.5 million, but I'm sure this is exaggeration. The Turks say around 200,000 died through the accidents of war, and the truth is probably somewhere in between these two statistics. So they were moved out of the area of conflict to Syria and Lebanon. Now, to begin with, the Armenians were not disloyal to the empire, but because of foreign interference and above all the territory ambitions of Tsarist Russia, they became so.
Well, now, but these derision, this derision that was already sitting and was actually made, used to benefit the Young Turks. I mean, what they basically did was during these exoduses and these marches and these problems and the deaths and destruction that came with it, they used this time to just cement their power structure, didn't they?
Yes, indeed. And, I mean, the Young Turks, they were really terrorists. That one who died later in Tajikistan, he had set up a revolt against, in the countryside, behind the Thessalonica, against the government in Constantinople. As we mentioned at the start of this discussion, the ethnic origins of the Young Turks themselves is disputable. Most of them came from the European parts of Turkey, especially around about Thessalonica, which was the principal area of Jewish settlement in the Balkans. Now, Ataturk was a half-Jew, and Inanu, his successor, was not a Turk at all. He was an Armenian.
Well, what we ended up with here, and there are families that are still in power today that had great sway in that period. One of them is Nicolas Sarkozy's grandfather, who was the Mahler family, was a very powerful family in Salonika, and involved at the very highest levels of this conspiracy. And of course, that we carry on today with the same influences that were prevalent during that period.
Yes. And indeed, the Donme are dominant in journalism and the media industry in Turkey.
Well, now, what kind of unique traits do these Donme have? I understand that Sabbateans, like their Frankist of bedfellows, have some very odd ritual and odd activities that they keep up to separate them from the rest of Judaism. One of them, they gave birth to actually a bohemian movement earlier on in history. They were involved in wife swapping and all kinds of bizarre ritualistic activities. And much of this has never been really well documented or talked about in modern times. However, I have read gobs of evidence from both inside Jewish community as well as outside that they are anything but orthodox religious and in service to God. They're more in service to I don't know. What do your studies tell you about this?
Well, Professor Shepherd, who was the chair of interdisciplinary studies and was a great Hebrew scholar, the chair of interdisciplinary studies at Oberlin in Ohio, was a close friend of mine. In fact, we worked very closely together in Spain. We were both educated in Spain. And he told me of a strange ritual whereby they would all gather, the Sabbateans, men and women, in a room, and suddenly the light would be put out, and people would copulate promiscuously, and you could even copulate with your own mother or your own sister under these circumstances, because you didn't know whose vagina you were entering, and that from that would from these unions children would be born.
And some of them, I'm sure...
It's not just an orgy. I mean, there was a religious background to it, because these people are heretical Jews.
Well, it's interesting because what we do know about Judaism...
It may have been an attempt to incarnate the Messiah as an Antichrist. That he would be born of one of these strange demi-satanic rituals.
Well, now, satanic, what's the connection to the satanic part of this through the Sabbateans? And I mean, because we know the Frankist movement developed as a political movement from the same group. We know the term to be a bohemian, it doesn't have the sinister nature of bohemian that I know about. A lot of bohemian thoughts and processes came out of this Sabbatean mindset. So what is some of the satanic parts of this that you've been able to find in your research?
So far, nothing really significant, but I'm hoping to.
Well, what we have...
Undoubtedly, that person who wrote the Brotherhood in English, he was very indiscreet, and he asked the Masons, what is the name of your God? And when they hesitated to answer, he realized it was the devil.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see a lot of the signs, you know, where they put the index finger and baby finger up in a demonstration of, well, actually, it's in the Kabbalah, and they're very close to Kabbalistic belief systems. But they also have a lot of, the Kabbalism and magic seem to come out of this Ashkenazi-born mindset that where Sabbatai Zvi was given his power from. But it developed from the 8th century until modern times as a rather secretive and bizarre group of practitioners, in my view, that had almost no relationship to what Sephardic Jews were following in the rest of the world. Where do you see this Kabbalism involved in Judaism today?
I don't know. I mean, I guess the Kabbalah is a secret, is an occult cult, and very difficult to penetrate, although I understand that the Hollywood celebrities are very deeply into Kabbalah.
Well, they are, and you know, people like Nostradamus was a Kabbalistic Jew. Well, a lot of the famous magicians of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century that traveled around the courts of Europe were Kabbalistic Jews as well. And we know that they plied their trade in oddity through this practice, and goodness knows what it actually does or doesn't do. One of the things that I'm certain of is that the product of it, or the work product of it, is always some sort of evil perpetrated on the helpless or the hapless. In either instance, people who are either unknowing or unable to fight back seem to be victims of these people's activities in almost every instance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they have some political influence, because wasn't there some Kabbalistic group or individuals behind Jesus and his rise to power in 18th century Germany? They became the most powerful man in the state of Württemberg, more powerful than the king.
Well, this is true. And what we do also find out is that they work best in secret. And that's, therefore, you'll note that whenever you see a secret organization, where people from outside that organization are never allowed in, you'll find that it spawns all kinds of trouble. Now, there's a group right now fanning itself out around the world called Chabad Lubavitch, or the Lubavitch. And the Chabad Lubavitch right now is setting up these Chabad centers are all over China, all over the Orient, all over the United States. Almost every major city in America has a Chabad center. And, of course, you're not allowed in that center and never get to know anything that's going on in there. And people are not, they don't feel able to question the activities of this center, because they feel it would be an affront to a religious privacy. But in fact, there's nothing farther from the truth that goes on in there. We noted that the Mumbai attack was orchestrated out of a Chabad house. So
that is true, yes. Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of the new secret societies being spawned here, because I think Freemasonry has been neutered in some respects by history, and they need a new place to drive their criminality out of, and a lot of them, in my view, it's happening through these Chabad houses.
Well, Freemasonry no longer has the power or the control over politics that it had in the 19th or early 20th century. That's for sure.
Hmm. Well, they also try to set up innocuous or uneventful organizations that ultimately end up being identified as having a lot more power than first thought. The Trilateral Commission, the CFR, the Roundtable, all of these organizations end up, you discover after the fact that they held great seats of power within their organizational structure, and at their pinnacle or at their top, always a Jewish figure driving either the activities or the infrastructure of the organization forward.
They are, in fact, a clandestine world government. And I'm sure they overlap, because if we knew the membership of these organizations, like the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, that we would find the same names appearing under different combinations.
That's right, James. That's why I brought it up. And even so much as saying that the British royal family is rooted in Judaism in a lot of its areas. I mean, Mount Battenberg and that whole strain of family membership is as Jewish as you can get. And of course, we have discussed repeatedly on broadcast how many of the peers now are actually of Jewish blood.
Well, Mountbatten was married to one of the Cassells.
Well, there you go. And of course,
and you know that Jewish blood may have entered the British royal family with Prince Albert, because Prince Albert's mother had a Jewish lover, and his father was impotent. Now, of course, people who are impotent don't advertise the fact. They don't give a date and say, on such and such a day, I discovered that I was impotent. So what we do not know is whether his father became impotent more than 9 months before Albert was born or after it. Because if it were before the conception of Albert, then certainly Prince Albert's father was a Jew.
Well, but we also, I mean, how did Lord Mountbatten, who Prince Charles actually said was his most influential relative?
Oh yes. Yeah,
and of course,
the two principal influences on Charles's upbringing are Mountbatten and Lawrence Vanderpost.
Both from that chosen community, if you will.
Well, I just know that Vanderpost was an Afrikaner who was looked on as a traitor by his own community. And I know that he was a spy for the British during the Second World War in Indonesia. I really know very little about him. But he has been a tremendous influence on Charles's thinking. Especially, Charles is a very spiritual person, and he has inclined him toward spiritualism.
Well, now, so we can safely say that the first concept that was driven forward on the idea of Israel was certainly made well in advance of its birth date of 1948. Of course, but the result has been a place in the world where this group can fan itself out around the globe and act with impunity in many cases. And with clandestine contacts of Jewish communities worldwide, you'll see that, of course, the connections to the New York and Chicago Jewish community out of Israel makes their, you can't deny these ties. You can't deny the City of London's ties back to many of these Jewish financiers and business owners, and even here in France as well. What do you see as the biggest challenge we face right now in exposing this crime network, James, and Israel as a fraud?
Well, that's a question I can't answer, but I want to quote Hitler in Mein Kampf. He said that the main purpose of Israel is their desire to have a state where they can carry out the operations of their skullduggery free from the supervision of the Gentile police. But that might apply to Germany. It certainly wouldn't apply to Britain, because in Britain, the police force is precisely, of all the professions, the one most under the control of Freemasonry. You cannot get promotion in the British police force without belonging to a lodge. Now, criminality, it has been pointed out that the Jews, who are in the bulk of them Ashkenazim, come from the Caucasian region, and that they are an Armenoid people, the Khazars, and these Armenoid groups seem to have predisposition toward criminality. Now, it so happens that now in America, in Canada, and perhaps also in Europe, there have been formed various criminal organizations by Russian Jews who left Russia after the collapse of communism, migrated to the capitalist West, and that these mafias are known by the city of their origin in Russia, that there is, for instance, St. Petersburg Mafia, an Odessa Mafia, and so on.
Yeah. Well, they also get alliances built out of the Jewish communities that have already been well established, and we can take a look at places like Canada, with the Brothman fortune being the predominant power broker there. Or if you can go to Sweden and see the Bonnier Jewish connection, or you can go to
South Africa
as well.
Yeah.
I mean, they kicked me off the air down there, and you can also see the power out of Chicago, the Jewish community through the Prixners and the Crown family, that were actually propagating and pushing forward Golda Meir before she was even, because of course she lived in Wisconsin.
She was an American. She was born in Kentucky.
Yes, and grew up in a Wisconsin area, but it was the Chicago Jewry that groomed her for her migration back to Israel and her seat that was taken there. So she was being run by Jewish influences both in Chicago and New York, and we can see those same influences well at work right now behind Obama, through Rahm Emanuel and through Axelrod and through Prixner and through the Crown families. And so basically we are still living under the direct control of this crime gang. How do we go forward here, James, and win this battle
But can we win it? I mean, these are the people who are behind the assassination of Kennedy. Kennedy was instituting financial reforms that would have undermined the power of Jewry, and would have circumscribed the power of the Federal Reserve Board, which is in fact the secret government of America. And in addition to that, he had ordered an investigation of the Israeli atom bomb. And we know that the moment he was assassinated and Johnston took over, Johnston ordered the investigation to be stopped.
Well, that's exactly right. But you know, he was put into power as one of them. It wasn't until he got into power that he began acting independent of this crime network. And there's a lot of books written about and a lot of things that have been said on the quiet, on the QT, about how people were angry that he had betrayed the people that put him in power. And of course, his wife was Jewish. His wife came from Jewish roots.
Jacqueline?
Yes.
I didn't know that, but his mistress, Judith Exner, was a gangster's mole, and through her, he was linked to organized crime.
Well, that's right, but Jacqueline Beauvais Kennedy, Jacqueline Beauvais was she had Jewish roots.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, it's in fact, when she started dating the Jewish shipping magnate Onassis, and then married him, many Jews said it was her first real marriage.
Well, I think I was the only person in Britain not to be astonished when she married Onassis. And the reason for this is that when I was a student in Madrid, I was a vicario of the Sección de Relaciones Culturales of the Spanish Foreign Ministry. Now, you know that the foreign ministry in each country tends to recruit amongst the aristocracy. And when I was looking for a place to stay, they had a list, you know, of down at heel aristocrats who would take in boarders, but very discreetly. And I was boarded out with Maruja Padilla, who is a descendant of the famous Padilla, who is the mistress of Pedro Peter the Cruel, Pedro el Cruel, in the 14th century. She showed me the family tree once. Now, there were two other people staying there. One was a Brazilian girl from Bahia, and the other was the daughter of the Belgian Minister of Economy. And she was modeling in Madrid, and she would ask the photographers not to take too many photographs of her, because since her parents didn't, it would enable her parents to trace her, because they didn't want her to marry this bullfighter in Seville that she was in love with. Now, she is the only person I've ever known who belonged to the beautiful people, and she told me many stories, but only one of them is relevant here. She said that she, along with her mother and father, had been invited to tea in the White House, when suddenly a row broke out between Jack and Jackie over the teacups, and Jackie said to Jack, "If you can have one," meaning a mistress, "then I can have one too." So they were both at it.
Well, you know, the truth is now what we find here is that the world's what we understand as history is nothing more than a rewrite and a whitewash of the facts. And for you and I to sit on this broadcast and try to dig into it, we won't maybe get it 100% accurate, but what we can say is it certainly is not the story that we've been told, and that the consequences for the Palestinians, for the Lebanese, for the Iraqis, for all of the Egyptians has been nothing short of catastrophic, and we're at a point now where the world is waking up, James, and what we need to do is wake them up with facts that are going to be relevant to this battle.
I think the world is waking up because of the expansion in electronic media. You see, there only are about five or six information agencies like Universal Press and Reuters in the whole world. So it's very easy for the Jews to use these to filter the information that gets through to the public. But with the internet, you know, there is now a deluge of information on the internet that people can access. Gradually, people are waking up to things.
Well, James, you know, when I started, no one was talking about these facts. No one. And I got to be honest with you, the internet was absolutely void of these subjects. And in fact, when I first started broaching these subjects, and you were one of my guests that helped me do that, I was threatened. I was called crazy. I mean, I've been slandered in every way you can think of. And I almost had no traction for these facts in the beginning. What's happened since I started doing this 4 or 5 years ago is that people have taken a look at these books I put on the site. Of course, you know many of them, Douglas Reed and Paquita de Shishnarev, and we've got so many of them on there, Elizabeth Dillings.
These are books, titles that one never sees in the bookshops in W.H. Smith's or in the public libraries. You can generally only obtain them through book clubs.
Well, you can get them through Daryl Bradford Smith's website.
Well, that's a new one on me.
You didn't know those books are on my website?
No, I must take a second look at it.
Well, I've got 40 books on that website, including some of the great writers of history that have outed these people, and I've read every one of them, James. That's why I know so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that we're in a very late hour here because suffering is real. I mean, people's financial lives have been devastated in many instances and getting worse every day. And this translates into some real suffering. So there is an urgency.
We face an apocalypse, I have no doubt about it.
Well, the urgency.
And American capitalism is destroying the universe.
Well, it isn't capitalism. And see, to put the name capitalism on what we've got today is really an abomination. Capitalism is anything but the system we are living under today. We're living under crony criminality here, where we have a system where if you are an insider and you've got the right kind of religion, you're going to be shoved up to the top and the heck with the rest of you. And I can tell you that's true through every industry that's important on this planet. You do not go up if you are not a part of the chosen group, and that chosen group happens to always be part of this Jewish crime gang, whether it be telecommunications or media or oil companies or computer businesses or software or search engines like Google or Yahoo. They're all in the hands of Zionist Jews, including the manufacturer of most of our products, cars, weapons, Dassault, the jet makers, Jewish, and his assistants that make Lagardère, all Jewish. I mean, come on, you go down the list, and basically every major industry of our planet is in their hands. So,
well, you know, it was said that in the Third Republic, which collapsed in 1940 under the impact of the panzers, and it's been described as a paradise of crooks, that there were only three routes to the top. One was to be a Jew, the second was to be a Freemason, and the third was to be a homosexual. If you were all three together, you'd end up as prime minister, or at least a cabinet minister.
Well, you know, Dominique de Villepin, from the man that's been fighting it out with Nicolas Sarkozy, in his private conversations with people, calls Nicolas Sarkozy a malignant dwarf. So, you know, I imagine that's probably as close as you're going to get to describing this guy. What we have here, James,
But the French are not naive, politically naive, the way the British are. I know they are ruled by alien elements, but they know it too. But the British don't realize this, that they are under alien control. For instance, I spoke a year or two ago with a famous Iraqi historian who works at UNESCO in Paris, and I said, is it true what they say, that the French despise the Arabs, but they hate the Jews? He said, it is true.
Yeah, but they allow them to run their television programming, and they allow them to own all of their businesses. They buy their televisions from them. They buy their books and their whiskeys and their drinks and their Ricard and their Renault and all of the products from them, and they do it without a whim. So I don't know how much they despise them. No.
And no, they despise the Arabs, but they hate the Jews.
Well, hatred doesn't stop them from enriching these people, does it?
Yeah, no.
Well, anyway, we've come to the end of our hour, James, and I'd like to give you an opportunity here at this last moment here to maybe have a parting statement for everybody that's listened in tonight.
Well, I just want to recount my recent visit to Turkey. I was for exactly 1 month,
yep.
Giving a series of talks at Sakarya University on the on Anglo-Ottoman relations in the 19th century and how these convoluted relations contributed to the outbreak of the First World War. Something like the areas of discussion that we've touched on this evening, Darrell.
Yep.
And you know, after each lecture, people would come up to me from the audience and say how refreshing it was to have a fresh insight on Turkish history, so different from the official version. And I said, what is the official version? Said, one we were taught at school. And I said, but sure you weren't naive enough to believe it. No, they said, we knew it was not true, but we do not know what the true version is. So you see, we come back to the definition of history, and the best definition of history is given by the man who made most of it, namely Napoleon. His definition of history was a lie that is no longer disputed.
There it is. Well, the history I work off of is a little more accurate, I believe, and you know, it has brought me into headbutting with a lot of powerful organizations and including governments and goodness, it's a scary thought. But I've often thought to myself, James, that if we don't win this battle, then with the advances in technology, we may never be able to fight back again. That, you know, because once they've locked us down with these new technologies that are coming, face recognition, and you know, you get your money through a debit card and the rest.
Identification cards, yeah, all that.
We may never be able to mount a resistance against these people. So I think that if we're going to be free as humans, now's the time to get off our backsides and do our darndest to make that happen for ourselves. And that's what I believe. And you've been very helpful in helping me to get these messages out. There are tens of thousands of people. By the end of the month, 60 to 80,000 people will hear this.
Really?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, well, in that case, I haven't spoken in vain or lived in vain, have I?
Well, no, you haven't.
I may have incurred the wrath of the Orientalist establishment, which has been keeping me out of university chair for decades, but at least I've achieved something.
Well, you have indeed, and one of them is to be a good colleague of mine and a good friend, and I want to thank you again, I'm going to say goodbye to everybody, and this will be the end of our broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, and I want to thank again James Dickey, Yakov Zaki, for his most important information, and until the next time, make sure your families are cared for. We are facing some very desperate times. Reach your hand down behind you and lift them back up if they've fallen. Care for them, because this is a tough time to be a human being, ladies and gentlemen, and if we are sticking together, we're going to win this fight. Until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please be well. Bye-bye now.